Hey everyone, this is Timothy Styles, and on today's particular episode of Turnbuckle Boogie, myself and Cutthroat Cody will be talking about the highs and lows of Vince McMahon. Now, today's episode is only part one of two, and part two will air next week. If you care to support the show, please go to the show notes, click on the link. It'll redirect you to our Brainbuster Tea store, where you'll be able to purchase t-shirts, hoodies, things like that. You'll get to cover your torso, we'll get a couple of bucks, and we can keep the lights on. Thanks so much, and let's boogie! Hey everyone, welcome to Turnbuckle Boogie. I am professional wrestling historian Timothy Styles, and with me, my co-host, professional wrestler, Cutthroat Cody Hancock.
Ahoy me mateys.
How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you today, sir?
Nice. We're actually recording this on a Saturday because of what's about to happen. And as opposed to a late Wednesday evening.
Yes.
So, you know, it's the weekend. I'm feeling good. I'm not exhausted from a week's work or whatever. But I guess I've already alluded to it. I'll get to the point. Wednesday in the afternoon, I said, is it time to pull the trigger on Vince McMahon?
Yes.
Because this is something we've been sitting on for a while. Like when season three... Before we started, I sat down and I wrote the list of, all right, who's going to get covered in season three? And I decided to put on the list the single greatest ECW world champion of all time.
Oh my
Vincent
goodness.
Kennedy McMahon.
There we, I mean, that I think... is how he's going to hope he is remembered in the history of professional wrestling.
No, I'm sure that's not true. But, you know, and we started season three before recent allegations of sexual misconduct and things of this nature. Hush money, you know, that's a big buzz phrase that's going about, came about. So when it started, the allegations and stuff, the Wall Street Journal articles and things of that nature. Every week we'd go, should we do Vince now? And I said, let's wait.
Yeah, not yet.
Let's wait and see what's going to happen. Every week something would come up. Oh, now it's, you know, $12 million. Let's wait.
Yeah.
he steps aside from the CEO position. Let's wait. And then finally... he retired, and it was rather unceremonious, you know, just a simple tweet. Well, that's it. I'm 77.
Bye, guys.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
Bye. It's like, And I even almost wanted to wait another week, because when someone who's that important in the industry just retires sort of just offhandedly, quietly, it's like, oh, something's around the bend.
Right. And I think that we're still within the intro segment, so there's a lot to talk about. And that's also another thing is that there is, we're not necessarily capping any form of time on this. We'll see how far we go, but I mean, there's a lot to uncover.
Well, yeah, the reason why we said, let's do Saturday, or at least I proposed to you, let's do Saturday, because we're not limited to time. And quite honestly, I'm almost predicting this might be a two-parter. Now, it may not be. I don't want to let anybody down.
Right.
But it may possibly be. Because, to me, I think Vince McMahon has two careers. Or at least two generations of careers, so to speak. There's the super successful 80s and 90s. This is after me sort of thinking about him for a couple of weeks. You know, after him saying, I'm done. Bye.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, well, what is this guy's legacy ultimately? And if you really stand back and look at it, it's like, well, the 80s and 90s were so prosperous and so wonderful and such a great time to be a wrestling fan. But the other part, you know, the second part of his career are the new millennium years.
Yes.
And although he would become a better businessman, he would proceed to produce a product that would make me, I'm being over the top here, but make me fucking sick.
Yeah.
And there's no nice way to put it. It was a rapid decline. Actually, 20 years, we'll say it's a slow decline. But yeah. A slow decline in numbers, but a rapid decline in my own interest in that brand. Every now and then they'd have something pop up that would be interesting, and I'd stick around for a little bit. In some cases, I'd stick around for a while. But ultimately, in the end, I mean, as it stands right now, you know, I haven't watched WWE regularly in what feels like years at this point.
Yeah.
Because it's become more of an enjoyable, less of an enjoyable experience and more of a chore.
Yes.
And I do not want one of my favorite things on this earth to feel like a chore. So I won't watch it.
And that's the thing is I think that it's really hard for me, at least from my standpoint and my views and opinions, it's hard for me to try to pin one person as the guy that, like, hey, it all starts here, right? I think that there is other people that should be held accountable for bad decisions, but one thing that
here's the thing. I want to quickly interject. I almost imagine today as something of a sort of a people's court. Judge Timothy Styles presiding, and the role of the prosecution and the defense will be to you.
I'm very conflicted in how I feel.
Yeah, exactly. We all are, right? Because there's a lot of great in this 40-year span, but there's also a lot of crummy. And that's not even taking into account all this recent business.
Well, what I was going to get at is that with accountability, you know, he is going to end up having to hold himself accountable for whatever is about to be uncovered, because we went from the first female that was brought forward into the press that was unnamed, but was...
I don't think it was unnamed.
She was a paralegal.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Rita What's-Her-Face, the referee from back in the...
No, I'm talking about at the beginning of the tailspin of Vince McMahon being investigated by his own company.
Sure.
At first, when it was just the one name, he went out on Monday Night Raw and was very excited to be there. And we're bringing John Cena back, and you're going to get all the things that you like from WWE. And I'm so excited, I'm going to jump off the ring steps. And that I will always remember as... To me, when I saw that happen, I'm like, this guy really is trying to wave in everyone's face. I ain't worried about this.
Right.
I'm going to be on TV and I'm going to start my show off and I'm going to tell everyone what they want to hear.
I bet you that's the way he feels right now.
And I don't know if that's the case, though, because you go from being opening up Monday Night Raw and jumping off the ring steps to I'm going to retire on Twitter.
Yeah, but there's something to be said about age.
Yeah.
At a certain point, you get to an age where you just go, I don't fucking care. And
right.
77, and if you're worth $3.6 billion, what the fuck do you care?
Right.
You know, because ultimately, we're talking about a white-collar crime here.
Yeah.
This is shit that I don't fucking care about. It's a matter of, you know... First of all, I can't understand this sort of white collar deal where it's super rich guy and wife who have an open relationship and they're free to fuck around, but you know, so he chooses whatever sort of sexual proclivities he gets into, he's able to sort of make them go away through non-disclosure agreements. That's something I could never even comprehend.
Right.
Right. Now it's a big question because it's a publicly traded company. Is this personal funds or is this company funds? And quite honestly, because he has the majority of the stock, the two are questionably synonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this is something for people on Wall Street to be concerned with. The fact that, you know, he's fucking around on his wife and she clearly knows about it and doesn't give a shit is neither here nor there. It's almost as if these sort of allegations are almost not important to the sum of this guy's huge career. Now, there is speculation, but that's all it is at this point, that,
right,
that he made propositions to a wrestler or two,
yep,
female, to be clear. Because I feel like I have to say that because I feel like this guy jerks off to Roman Reigns.
Probably.
And John Cena and whoever else. The speculation is that his advances were thwarted and that she was eventually let go or whatever. And you can, but that all that shit's speculation.
Right.
So I'm not even planning on bringing it up into the conversation. Now, having said all of this stuff so far, I didn't want to start at the end and work backwards. I figured we should start at the beginning.
Yep.
And work forward.
That sounds good to me.
Chronologically makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
You know, and really things start, I mean, the McMahon family goes back a very long way. I mean, Vince McMahon's grandfather was an Irish immigrant and a boxing promoter who then had a son who would go on to be a boxing promoter and then eventually a wrestling promoter. So that Capital Wrestling Entertainment Company, whatever it was called, you know, it was the New York territory. It was already established and the biggest territory in the country,
yep,
if not the world, obviously. When Vince McMahon Jr., Kennedy McMahon, came into contact with it and basically bought it from his dad 2 years before he died.
Yeah.
You know, so that's his start buying, you know, because you see interviews with him where he's like, oh man, I, you know, had it rough. You know, I had to buy, you know, with these balloon payments. And if I didn't make my, you know, make the payments, we were going to go under. It's like, you had the New York territory. It's the fucking hugest territory in history.
Right.
How could that fail?
Well, and especially when it's already established, and right, it's kind of something that I think that a lot of people will always say, well, look what McMahon did when he got it from his dad. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, that's one way to look at it. But if, like you're saying now, if you go and you actually do the research, it was already there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that already being there, kind of already set, there's people that think that no matter what they see in a wrestling ring, it's WWE.
Right.
And there's people that will,
of those people, I find probably still call it WWF.
Yes. And they will.
Right.
And it's the household name.
It is, and the Band-Aid, the Kleenex, the Jell-O.
Yes.
Of its brand.
Yes. And that was, I don't want to necessarily say handed to Junior.
It wasn't handed.
Right.
Because, you know, we're going to have some debates today, and you and I might be on the same side of some things. We might differ on others.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of talk about, for years, that Vince McMahon killed the territories. And
yep,
in some cases, that's absolutely true. And in some cases, it's kind of not. Because, you know, he had a vision to take a business that was separate from the NWA and turn it into a global, you know, IP that was worth a damn.
Yes.
Like anyone who were to start up a startup business today, that's their idea. I want to create a thing that I can sell to people in China and you know, India or wherever, right? He wanted to do something not just for, you know, Connecticut, New York, Philadelphia, and wherever else that,
right,
their territory. But unfortunately, the NWA, that string of promoters, that you know, 30 plus promoters that had different territories were so fucking old school minded and had no interest in bringing that industry to a new level that when he made that move, a lot of them were left in the dust, and a lot of them did not even bother to compete. They just closed the fucking doors. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, he deliberately went after some to expand, but some of them were just like, ah, fuck it, and just retired as millionaires, you know? So on one hand, yeah, is he guilty of expanding? Yes, but who else wouldn't?
Right.
You know, who had any brains? Because those territories, really, it was just the promoters who were getting rich.
Right.
The people who own that territory, the owner and then the star of said territory who had a 10% or more cut of that particular territory.
You're correct.
Everyone else was fucking working, you know, hand to mouth.
And that's something too that I think that wrestling has always had peaks in popularity.
Yeah.
And I think that when you have WWE, anytime that they've had a dip in popularity, they have enough money to keep themselves headstrong, above water, and able to still function. And then,
well, we're talking about a publicly traded company.
Yes. Whereas you have a company like the NWA, who, despite,
well, the NWA wasn't a company. The NWA, right, was just a sanctioning body that didn't really, yeah, have an office, what the NWA was. But technically, it was a bunch of different smaller organizations who all abided by this one rule, you know, because they could help each other.
Right. And when popularity goes down.
Right.
And there's not enough to keep people coming in the door to keep the lights on and things of that nature. Do I think it was purposeful? It's hard to say, because
do you think what was purposeful?
Him destroying the territories.
Sure. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Yes, it was purposeful.
And the buyout of all the libraries and things like that. McMahon didn't seem like he wanted to have competition in some areas.
Oh, no, he certainly didn't.
And that didn't just start with the Monday Night Wars.
No,
right?
No. I mean, he really got his first pushback with Bill Watts.
Yeah.
And then Bill Watts was the only person he didn't want to fuck with, because Bill Watts knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
Even though he was a crazy racist tyrant. Read some books, folks. You'll learn.
Yeah.
Although, I don't want to completely throw the R word around. He was known for some things that were beneficial, but, you know, tough to take the Southerner out of the boy. You can take the boy out of the South.
Yep, but you can't take the South out of the boy.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, he wanted to make... He had no affiliation with this group whatsoever.
Yep.
You know, he was free to do whatever it is that he wanted. Because I think the history of the WWWF and Capital Wrestling or whatever, I forget the lineage of the names, you know, they were part of the NWA, then they left, then they came back, and then they left again, you know. It was already 10 years plus by the time Vince McMahon bought that company that they were not associated with the NWA at all and didn't even bother to pretend that it existed. They, yep, would promote some crossover stars, like, you know, because they were still sending out Andre the Giant to other territories because he couldn't just stay,
yep,
in the WWF. So, you know, they bring in like Dusty Rhodes when he was an independent star, basically just doing the same gimmick as Andre.
Yep.
You know, bring him in, have a big match, you know, against superstar Billy Graham or something like that. But when he took over, he made a conscious effort to make it better. And he did the one thing that a lot of these guys didn't do. He reinvested his money in the product to make it better and better and better.
Yep.
As far as quality, you know, the quality of the graphics went up, the quality of the camera and the camera work went up, and the production in general. He reinvested in a lot of those stars from other territories. And, you know, you hear a lot of, he raided other people's stars. It's like, these people are independent contractors.
Right.
Ironically, years later, he would then utilize the same old tactics to keep them his.
Yes.
Instead of other people's. That's the ugly side of the business. You know, there's things that he did that improved the industry, and then some old things that he kept because they only benefited him and the company.
The World Wrestling Federation explores the outer limits of bad taste. It is to Olympic wrestling what striptease is to Greek tragedy. Its grotesque heroes make even Mick McManus look like a merchant banker. The World Wrestling Federation is no stranger to hustle or bustle, but its head office in peaceful Connecticut allows wrestling impresario Vince McMahon to seek the creative inspiration which is the secret of his success.
From there, Hulk is scheduled for a premiere of his cartoon series.
Since taking over from his father, McMahon has almost single-handedly turned American wrestling from an old-fashioned grunt-and-groan spectacle into an unfolding melodrama for mass audiences.
The hype leading up to the match is very carefully choreographed. Vince McMahon literally looks upon that hype the same way the producer of Dynasty or Dallas looks at his screenplay. They have one man who sits in a room year-round and writes scenarios 6 months in advance for what's going to happen leading up to these matches.
In the wrestling business, it's a question of two or more individuals going out to the ring, wrestling, having a little bit of applause or what have you from the audience, and it's time to go home until the next match. That's not really what we do. We're in the sports entertainment business, and there is a huge philosophical difference between being in strictly the wrestling business and being in the sports entertainment business as we are.
Amidst the scramble for quick bucks and instant excitement, a lone voice of dissent is making itself heard.
I think it stresses everything which is dirty, underhanded. I think it teaches that you've got to be dirty in order to be successful in this life.
Senator Abe Bernstein is a New York lawyer who wants to introduce legislation to have McMahon's shows banned.
It glorifies brutality and physical violence and reminds me of the Roman days of gladiators.
You don't see knives, you don't see guns. You don't see rapes, you don't see anything at all like that that's portrayed in anything that we do. It's a very wholesome, family-oriented environment.
At some point, you can't fault somebody for wanting to make sure that they're taken care of too, but when it comes at the downfall of others, and...
Well, that's capitalism.
Yes, it is, and that's what's sad about it.
Well, yeah... I guess so. You know, here's the point I made very early on. Here he is trying to improve the industry. You know, that's the whole idea behind sports entertainment. He felt, and he was right, that a lot of these sort of Southern brands had deteriorated in the average American conscious what professional wrestling meant.
Yeah.
When people heard the words pro wrestling, they think of just bleach blonde fat guys bleeding profusely on newsstands, you know. And he wanted it to be something more socially acceptable. And this is an area where I think is a positive, you know. So a lot of these people, these promoters and owners of territories, when he made moves to improve the industry, in some cases, you know, he was aggressive with some of the bigger ones when he basically bought Georgia and made a move for all these different territories. And when they didn't, when they scoffed at him, you know, and he went to their television and bought their time slots.
Yep.
For double whatever money those people were paying, you know, they folded. But a lot of them, you know, because we're talking about 30 plus territories, a lot of them just went, fuck it, I can't compete. Or they went under because their stuff was so low budget compared to the WWF's at the time, because they did not reinvest that money that they made into their own product. They just coasted for generations, and it just took one guy to completely tear down the entire system that they had built up.
Which is crazy.
Right. And it's not like he would did anything that any other venture capitalist wouldn't have done.
Right. And yeah. it's easy to... I always try to put myself in the position of others,
right?
You know, and try to think about it from their point of view. And the amount of work and effort that you have to put in, and in order to secure making your business a profitable, successful venture.
Right.
McMahon was successful.
Yeah.
With the way that he did things.
But he also, he had a leg up because he had the New York market.
Yes.
That's a great stronghold to start from.
Yes.
You know, if you could really look, it's funny.
He didn't start in Alaska.
I imagine if I paid a board game developer to make some new plastic minis and just use the map of Risk.
Yeah.
You know, the Risk map, where it's the map of the world. And instead of the little war figurines, it was just promoters and
yeah.
Yeah. And wrestlers.
That'd be funny.
If you started, you know, in whatever one of the better, if you start in New Zealand, you'd fucking suck.
Yeah.
You'd be blown out quickly. But if you started in America and you started expanding into South America and then crossing over into Russia, yeah, you got a good starting point.
That might be a great idea for a game.
I think there is actually one that already kind of exists.
Like that's
that.
Awesome.
You know, it's interesting. There's another key ingredient here that is the demise of the territories.
Yeah.
That he was smart to, that they were not smart to. Care to guess before I just give it away?
Go. You just go ahead.
Cable.
Yeah.
Cable made... television, you know, pretty, as opposed to territorial television, cable was broadcast across the country.
Yep.
And if you were on it, you were in every fucking territory. It didn't matter. And with the exception of World Class, wasn't World Class on ESPN? I believe it was.
Yeah.
I think maybe AWA later on. And, maybe even Bill Watts. I forget. But with the exception of those, everyone else were ill-prepared to take on that challenge.
Right.
This was going to happen anyway. Doesn't matter who was in charge. If Vince McMahon didn't exist, Fritz Von Erich or Bill Watts or probably Jim Crockett would have done it.
Yeah.
Or even Georgia, you know.
And to think about what came first, the chicken or the egg, you know, McMahon was able to get there first. And that is most certainly what made WWE a household name.
Yeah, it's really, if you look back on that entire time frame, it's easy to see why the people who came out ahead came out ahead.
Yeah.
You know. And it's easy to see why the people who ended up folding, why they folded. You know, Jim Crockett, you know, ended up having to sell to Ted Turner because they just expanded too rapidly instead of pacing themselves in an attempt to keep up with Vince. Also, there was some cutthroat shit back and forth between the two, pay-per-view wise, but that's besides the point. Who was the other one? World Class folded under its own stupidity, sadly. Yeah. And, you know, McMahon paced himself, and the people who really came out ahead were the ones who were investing their money into their own product to make it better.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, Cyndi Lauper is what really...
Rock and wrestling.
...turned the tide. It's weird to say in today's day and age, because it's like, what? That one girl with... 2-3 hits.
Yep.
Like, yeah, that's really all it took. One person to embrace pop culture instead of shunning it.
Yes.
You know, because it was always like they might have someone come in and be a special referee in some weird territory or something, but by and large, most territories did not want any attention from, because they wanted to protect the business and keep it to themselves.
Well, and that's great when they did that, but then look what happened with Kaufman and Lawler, because that became one of the blueprints for how to get a celebrity involved in the world of professional wrestling.
And more than that, you know who turned down Kaufman?
WWE.
Vince Sr.
There it is.
Because Bill Apter, Kaufman talked to Bill Apter, and he said, can you put me in touch with the WWWF? I want to do a thing with them. And Vincent J. McMahon Sr. said, no.
Yep.
He said no. And Bill Apter said, don't worry, I know other places, and called Kaufman or called Lawler.
Yep.
And Lawler said, fuck yes.
Yeah. And so when you see something like that be so successful, and I think that that probably helped the embrace of wanting to get celebrities involved with professional wrestling. And when it came to, Ozzy Osbourne came out with the British Bulldogs at some point, I thought.
Like, I forget, was that WrestleMania 4 or 5, something like that?
That's insane. That's so cool. Like, that's really neat.
Yeah, and the funny thing is it wasn't like it was this great string of celebrities. You know, it was Muhammad Ali way past his prime. It was, who's the piano player?
Liberace.
Yeah, Liberace, who, you know, he's probably having wet dreams up there with the Rockettes. Mary Hart, or, you know, it's like the host of Entertainment Tonight or shit that's like not really that important. But that was enough to get it in the public conscious. You know, he was very – one thing you can say about Vince McMahon, whether you like him or you hate him, the guy is the single greatest promoter of all time.
Yes.
And not just of professional wrestling. P.T. Barnum, you know, the Houdini – anyone who's ever been a promoter, this guy made people care about a fake sport for 4 decades. I don't know. Maybe Bill Watts could have pulled it off. Maybe Jim Crockett could have pulled it off. But this guy did it technically best and also worst.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he didn't know when to leave well enough alone.
Right. And I also think that it's just a matter of look at what was popular in the early 90s in professional wrestling. They ended up having to take a harsh turn from that. And then when you go from the cartoon era, mm-hmm. right, to the attitude era, and then when you see the decline in ratings, and then you switch over to the Ruthless Aggression era, nobody really wanted to hop on board with it, unfortunately. And I think that it was because people and their taste had changed. And unfortunately, there wasn't a really good, strong blueprint of what to follow. In the Attitude Era, there was a very easy blueprint. It's like people like to watch Jerry Springer and like to watch people throw chairs at each other.
I don't know. This is, I mean, we're getting ahead of ourselves because I'd like to stick to the 80s and 90s
right.
before we move on. But I think that there was a blueprint.
Yeah.
There was a business model change at a certain point where stars were not the draw anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The company was the draw. But the company could be good or bad. You know, he put that company on Stone Cold Steve Austin's back and took it to crazy heights. And when Steve Austin had to retire, The Rock followed suit.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, when they became a publicly traded company, it was not about stars anymore. That's a tectonic shift where things completely changed. It really wasn't about stars. And independent contractors who you could get under your thumb and, you know, they would be the face of your brand anymore. Anyway, that's we'll talk about that here soon enough.
Yeah.
I want to first talk about the 80s. Now that we got all the territory business out of the way, the golden age, as they like to call it.
Yep.
On the internets.
The world wide webs.
Yeah. WWW, all the W's.
Eight W's and an F.
Well, so Vince McMahon sees Hulk Hogan, Terry Bollea in AWA, who had already created Hulkamania and all this jazz, and decides this guy's going to be my star. And he was already spurned by Vern Gagne, and puts him up front, and they have at it. And he starts bringing in some serious characters from every goddamn promotion who were worth a damn. Piper, you know, I guess I don't need to rattle them all off.
Right.
We all know who were the cast in the 80s. And they completely took over the industry because they were colorful. It was a more innocent time. It was, you know, it was fun. It was still a little dangerous, despite the fact it was cartoonish compared to, say, Crockett and all the territories that were left over.
You know, right.
There was obviously less bloodletting, and it was more cartoonish. What do you think? How do you think that era holds up? How do you think it was at the time? I don't even know how old you are. I'm sure you were real young. And how do you think it holds up today?
I think that I was born in 85.
Mm.
So,
oh yeah, you were
a
fucking embryo.
So that's a huge chunk of time that I have gone back, obviously, and watched
right
retrospectively.
Right.
And that is something that I'm not a fan of the Attitude Era.
I'm talking about the 80s.
But, and that's what I'm saying is that for me, I oftentimes go back and watch things from the 80s and the early 90s because I just didn't really enjoy what was transpiring on television.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I
should put one thing into context here. It is interesting. You know, McMahon's run is synonymous with my own age. I'm 44.
Yep.
Ugh, which I hate to say out loud. God damn, what
happened?
You're
making it look easy.
Dude, I was young not that long ago. But everything that the WWE did for those first two decades seemed to match up with my age bracket.
Mm-hmm.
That 1980s, I was the perfect age to be a Hulkamaniac and then an Ultimate Warrior maniac and then a Macho maniac, or you know what I mean? Like, yep. I was in line with all that. And then when it started to go south because I was hitting puberty and I went, they wisely shifted focus. And that's when Steve Austin came into play. And I was 18 when that shit was going on.
Yeah.
I was the perfect age for that. So for two decades, it was perfect. Now, I almost have no concept of what it must be like to be born just 10 years later than me.
Yeah.
Which is what you were, basically. And to completely miss out on the 80s, essentially, and start in the 90s, I always thought it was strange, a lot of these people who are wrestlers now, when they talk about loving Shawn Michaels, and it's like, that guy was a fucking jerk off.
Yeah. And I wasn't necessarily a Shawn Michaels worshiper, I can tell you that much right now.
But I mean, but the fact that you say almost in retrospect, the Attitude Era was the shits. And it's like, I remember watching that shit every week. It was goddamn fun. But I have the context of everything else that was going on in the world at the time. I'm sure you watched it at the time too. You were just a bit younger.
I whenever I was watching wrestling, I would have rather watched ECW.
Right.
Which had a harder edge to it.
But there was some fun and exciting stuff prior to ECW being, you really had to find before their TNN show.
Yeah.
You really had to know what UHF channel they were on to find that Renegade shit. And if you didn't know about it.
And thankfully I knew about the Renegade shit.
Right, right.
And that's, I always preferred that because ECW, as hard of an edge as it had on it, it also prioritized in-ring action, right? It prioritized an in-ring wrestling product.
Right.
WCW entertained me very, very much. So I preferred WCW to WWF because
at the time
because there was more matches for me to watch than there was on WWF programming. I did not really enjoy DX. I was much more of a fan of Team WCW versus Team NWO.
And now, performing our next nominated tune is a man who has repeatedly proven that he cannot talk, and who tonight will prove that he can't sing either. Vince McMahon performing, and I believe this is good advice for all of you here and at home, to put your fingers up, your ears, and stand back, Vince McMahon.
I would say this is, it's interesting. When you say DX, there's like five different versions of DX.
It's about every version
I
just wasn't a fan of.
Well, DX 2.0,
mm-hmm.
when it started the day after WrestleMania 15, when Shawn Michaels lost the title to Steve Austin with Mike Tyson there and all that shit. 2.0, as I like to call it, started that day after.
Yeah.
That's where they had X-Pac. They Shawn Michaels wasn't there. They had the Road Dogg and Billy Gunn and China,
right,
of course. When that kicked off, the NWO was already on a down tick.
Mm-hmm.
So not that I historically think that DX was something great, and all now that Triple H is in the most coveted seat of power in the world of professional wrestling,
yep,
that is going to be even more romanticized.
Yes.
More than it should be, because it paled in comparison to the importance of the NWO. But I will not completely crap on all of DX. That 2.0 I thought was decent enough for its time period. And it helped elevate Triple H into that superstar status that he would go on to become.
And I undoubtedly, right? However, for me, I never really liked the things that other people liked. And I understand,
right,
I understand why people enjoyed it. And I get why people enjoyed it. But it just so happened that when I was being picked on in school, it was normally from jocks that were gigantic meatheads that would have catchy one-liners to tell you about putting your mouth around their genitals.
I always thought this was a rumor. I had never heard of jocks being that sort of stereotypical John Hughes type of character.
They were in my middle school, at least.
Not for me.
Yeah. And that is something, though, that... So for me, I'm just like, why would I want to cheer for these guys? Right. The concept didn't.
I have a feeling that there were a lot of jocks who wore NWO shirts, too. Let's get real.
But I also wasn't an NWO fan.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So.
Oh, that's right. You were
Crow Sting was my favorite.
Oh, I was going to say Shane Douglas, Bam Bam Bigelow.
Yeah, and I mean, Triple Threat was dope, too.
Yeah, Triple Threat. You were more of a Triple Threat guy.
Yeah, and I look back now and I see not only that, but just the quality of matches and the things that they were doing in matches in the late 80s and early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like nobody hardly looks at enough, and some of the way they were going into their stuff was brilliant. I loved it. That's the thing that captured my imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And then to see crowds react the way they used to.
What decade are we talking about here?
We're talking about in the 80s and 90s.
Right. Okay.
So to see the way that the crowds, the reactions were just on another level.
Yeah.
And then I liked pretty much anything other than actual WWF programming.
Mm.
Because...
Which is crazy to hear. I mean, it really popularized the industry.
Yeah.
It popularized it so much. They were printing money and they were able to go public.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something.
Oh, it absolutely is. And I appreciate the fandom,
right,
of it all. But
you just didn't enjoy it at all? You didn't like Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Stone Cold Steve Austin, I enjoyed for a period, but it got to a point where when I was a fan,
mm-hmm,
what?
Oh, that's later on.
But once again, though, on my brain.
When did he start that? It must have been 2000. It was post WCW.
Well,
and post ECW.
Regardless, the promos with the catchphrases, and mm-hmm, it was the same formula on TV all the time, and the TV matches. I think
you're casting a wide brush.
Well, whether I'm casting a wide brush or not, I'm just telling you how I see it and how I enjoy it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Right. The problem is when you think back to entire generations of a period of a brand.
Yeah.
It's easy to go, well, the whole Attitude Era was the shits. And it's like, at the time, if you were my age bracket,
yep,
it was fucking exciting. Like, it was water cooler talk. Like,
yeah,
my entire barracks, I was in the military.
Did you see Stone Cold Steve Austin's son, Santa Claus?
Everyone in my entire barracks watched that shit.
Yeah.
And we all, I mean, I was still calling home to my buddy going, oh, I can, you know, it was amazing last night. You know, we were playing WW, you know, this is the beginning of where you can create characters in video
Warzone,
games.
Yeah. Yeah. WWF Warzone.
Yeah. And it like, it was this very fun thing to be involved with, to watch when it came to your town, you wanted to go, you were playing the video games and you were not only, you know, in the in that barrack situation I was telling you about, we had a tournament in those, you know, because the video, they you could have like tournaments and, you know, 32 guys would enter into this tournament to, you know, see who'd be the champion of our floor and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it was a great time. It was very exciting at the time. Now, you can say 20, 30 years later, whatever, that it wasn't shit, or it was terrible, or, you know, choppy, choppy, the PP, but a lot of that stuff came later and really was the key to its downfall. It's tough to cast the years of its apex,
right,
of 97 to, basically the year 2000.
Right.
It's not almost not fair to cast that period with the rest of it where they were leading up to it and they were trying to figure things out. And it was a slow
right.
switch from the Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart era. And then the part where they led out of it where after Cactus Jack retired and it's like, now it's Triple H is going right. to be the baby face.
Well, and like, I liked the Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart era.
Cause you were an infant.
Well, no, because everything that you're mentioning that mm-hmm. everything that you just rattled off about you and your barracks and all the boys were into it. None of that mm-hmm. appealed to me about pro wrestling. And I'm not ignorant to think that other people,
I know that you're different.
Yes. Right. I'm very different.
Right.
All the things that I didn't like The Rock's promo style.
Right.
I didn't like the insult comedy stuff.
You didn't like,
I didn't like the one line catchphrases.
Right.
I also don't like action movies. Right. And and it's great for everyone else. And I'm glad that everyone else enjoyed it.
Right.
But for me, I would have rather seen Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart in the Iron Man match for an hour.
Mm.
Right.
Well, you're the one.
Yeah. That's me.
Well, no, of course everyone would love to see Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart go for an hour.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, what they had to sit through was 2.5 hours of, the Doinks and the Duke, the Dumpsters.
But
and the,
but even then I enjoyed Doink. I think Doink the Clown, like,
yeah, but I'm saying, yeah, that, but did you like Buffalo Head? What's that guy's name?
Tatanka?
No.
Oh, like Manitar?
Mantar? And all that stuff. You know, there it was a plethora of that.
Right.
Lex Luger and,
Oh, the narcissist Lex Luger was the best thing in the world for me.
Oh, my
yeah.
God.
Oh, yeah. And when he was a babyface against Yokozuna and he slammed him, like all that stuff, I bought hook, line, and sinker.
Bro, you're twisted. You're like a kid who's been molested, and you talk about the good old days of...
I'm just saying. Well, but like that's where you and I remember things about wrestling fondly in different areas of wrestling
because of our difference in age.
I don't know if it's necessarily our difference in age.
Well, it's two things. It is our difference in age because I was the perfect age for Hulkamania. Mm-hmm. I was the perfect age for Stone Cold's rise. But also, you, for whatever reason, whatever happened in your social makeup, or maybe you just saw past the stupid theatrics, you didn't like promos, you didn't like any, you put Stone Cold Steve Austin and fucking Dean Malenko next to each other and you go, I want the fucking Man of a Thousand Holds.
I wouldn't say that necessarily
it's a generality, but you know what I'm getting at.
Yes, and but I will say this is that When I watch Austin now, mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, it's brilliant that he was smart enough to adjust his style and things like that. But when I watch Austin, then I'm like, all he's doing is punching and kicking.
Right.
That's all that I saw. And I'm like, okay, well, like there's another wrestler that all he does is kind of punk, kick and choke. And that's Hulk Hogan. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like Hulk Hogan. I was more enamored by in-ring wrestling. There's a part of my brain, and I don't know why, but it has lent to me later on in my life to be a very good trainer, to be not just engaged with seeing the physicality of the action, but also seeing the manipulation of getting an entire room to respond unanimously in one way.
Unanimously.
Yeah, thank you, sir. In one way.
Right.
That's the CTE talking.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
someone get Chris Nowinski on the phone.
I'm just saying, I got mush mouth every now and again, and I've been hitting that a couple times. So, but there, stuff like that is what attracted me.
Sure.
And drew me to wrestling. It wasn't Stone Cold Steve Austin showing up on a fucking Zamboni.
Right.
Like, that's not, it wasn't anything like that. Now, granted, was it entertaining for television to see him make Vince McMahon pee his pants and then hold a gun to his head that said bang?
Right.
Like it was a Joker prop?
Right.
You know, sure. But I was also more enamored with watching Brian Pillman try to take a pencil and stab it in Mick Foley's ear.
Right.
Like the things that other people romanticize about wrestling are the things that maybe it's worth going back and trying to watch. I was talking about that with Casey the other night, my lady, and we were talking about Napoleon Dynamite, and we were both just like, man, we neither one of us got that movie. And it's like, okay, well,
it's a good movie.
It might be worth going back now and watching.
I don't know that you would have a newfound appreciation for it because it doesn't change.
Right. And that's, but at the same time, my sense of humor's changed a little bit, you know, so, and I always like to go back and watch some of those things. And the, like I said, for me, and it's still very much the same thing, like I pay attention to promos.
Right.
Because promos are a huge part of the industry. Mm-hmm. And Foley.
Well, without them,
you know,
you gotta promote, or it doesn't matter what fucking moves you do.
You gotta bring them into the door. Yeah. And I do have an appreciation for them. I don't want to just put a overall generalization of like, no, I hate everything about
it. No, I know that.
But there's some people that their promo style that I liked.
Right.
I didn't necessarily like Stone Cold's promo style. It was great that he was beer swilling, badass, and dude, but it was catchphrase.
I think you're overgeneralizing that.
Well, DTA, don't trust anybody.
Sure.
Okay. Because Stone Cold said so.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, but he wouldn't. It did not get to the levels of ridiculousness where you would hear like the greatest hits. He really mixed a lot of shit up.
Yeah.
And he did it in a way where he did a lot more speaking naturally.
Right.
Where when he would throw one in just to put a bow on it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, The Rock
got out of control because for some years he was creating new shit every week and it was fun, new and exciting. It was very selfish.
Yeah.
From a wrestler's point of view. But at a certain point, I don't know if he just stopped giving a fuck or he started eyeballing Hollywood.
Yeah.
And that's where the fucking innovation stopped. No more new stuff. You know, now we're going to, he's the Eagles. We're just playing the hits here. Poontang Pie.
Doesn't matter what your name is.
Strudel.
Yeah.
Jabroni Boulevard and
SmackDown Hotel. I will say, yes, The Rock was definitely, but like, once again, man, like it's even, let's say there's like a stand-up comedian that they have a lot of one-liners. I don't even like stand-up comedians that have one-liners. Like the you might be redneck jokes with Jeff Foxworthy.
There's an even more perfect example.
Okay.
Sam Kinison.
Okay.
Sam Kinison came out like hell on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what was the name of his first special? I think it was like Raising Hell or Hell on Earth, something like that. Anyway, it was brilliant.
It's Pastor Son.
It was one of the greatest specials that ever was created. And because he was coked out of his fucking gourd, he really just stopped creating. And by the time, you know, the last, you know, basically the 90s, I don't know that he wrote any fucking material after that. His comedy shows were really just him essentially being the fucking MC at a party.
Yep.
And just screaming a lot. No punchlines, no jokes, hugely overweight and dressed like a pirate and just fucking yelling shit that everyone knows.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It was like, this is great innovation initially, and then, but very quickly, that great character became a fucking uncreative cartoon parody of himself.
Right. And that's the, I like.
And a sad one, because he was just ballooning up and sweating profusely and fucking high on cocaine like crazy.
And you can just hear his heart pressure rising. You could every see in second.
His, you yeah. could see it in his face, because, like I say, he would wear like these long trench coats and fucking not a do-rag, but like a bandana.
Yeah.
With skulls and crossbones and shit on it. Yep. Just like he was sweating profusely for wearing all this shit and being coked and fucking the hot lights on him and everything. It was like, Jesus Christ, I feel bad for this guy.
Yeah.
Even though he's super successful for doing nothing.
Yeah. And that's something that I, even when I dabbled in the open mic scene for a little bit.
Oh, I thought you were going to say cocaine.
No. Yeah. Well, I mean, just a dabble, do you?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Give me a freeze.
Yeah. But when I was dabbling in hitting the open mic scene in Vegas,
right,
and I was doing really well, but I would do these open mics in different bars and there would always be different comedians, but there was always like the same cookie cutter comedians. And I had the disadvantage of seeing people on the indies try to be the next rock.
Right.
And they would try to cut these promos and they would even start their matches like The Rock would. And unless you were like an actual impersonation act,
right,
which Vegas did have at one point, I can't remember the guy's name, but this guy,
of The Rock?
Yes. And he wrestled for UPW, not out of California, but the Las Vegas based wrestling promotion, and Buffalo Jim, I think he may have had a match for. He had the tattoo on his arm.
What?
Right? Oh, absolutely. He had the Brahma Bull tattoo on his arm.
That this shit still went on at this time.
Yes.
This old carny stuff where they just, you know, put the doink wig on and put on the makeup and you're doink now.
Yeah. And
wild.
And he had the boots with the calves cut out of the back.
Explain the calf cutout.
To show that you actually have calves. That's why.
I know everyone wants to have original boots.
Yeah.
But the calf cutout.
The calf cutout, so if your calves are actually too large, you actually have to order boots that will accommodate the size of your calves. So the calf cutout, depending on who you are. I just assume
that they not a mold of your foot, but they would shape the boot leather to your foot and cut it out and sew it accordingly.
But due to the seams, for most wrestling boots, they are seamed directly in the back. But if your calf is too bulbous,
mm-hmm,
that will wrap around fucking with the dimensions and the cut of the boot.
Mm-hmm.
And for bodybuilders that actually have calves, they want to show their calves.
He could have got some fucking wrestling shoes.
Yeah. Well,
then his whole fucking legs would be exposed. Yeah,
but regardless, calf boots, tattoo, moveset, it's all everything. And it's great for, you know, a couple people in a warehouse, you know, but you're not going to make a substantial career off of being the most popular wrestler, because the most popular wrestler beat you to it. Like that,
especially if you're doing his entire act.
And like when I was doing comedy, there was a Jeff Foxworthy guy, which was the redneck with the one-liners, right?
Did he have a new, his own original sort of?
Oh yeah, he had original stuff, but it was all the same blueprint of, you might be a redneck.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yes. I'm wondering if he had his own line, because I do like that as a good joke. It's if your grass is higher than your car,
yeah,
you might be a Southern person.
Yes, it's more or less. That's basically what it was. They had like their own Carrot Top, and he had props, and he was zany.
Wow.
You know.
By the way, I think you and I were probably doing open mic comedy. Probably around about the same time. I don't remember any of these people.
Well, I saw them across like three different bars, and they were all different people, and they were all.
By the way, folks, if you're looking into getting into stand up comedy, Las Vegas open mic scene sucks, and don't do it.
Well, there might be a resurgence though.
Oh, so really?
Shout out my buddy Marco. Marco is a very funny gentleman.
Marco, take everything you've learned and move to New York immediately. You'll get a million times better. Look, I'll just cut right to the chase. It's a terrible place to try to start a career in show business. There's too much shit going on.
Yep. And I just didn't like the structure of the way that they were doing this. And it was...
Well, you were really going to hate the years to come then.
But it was bizarre to me.
Right.
Like, and I would like, why does everybody like this? Why is this the thing? Like, The Rock telling somebody it doesn't matter what their name is.
Well,
like,
at the beginning, the first time, I'm sure it was, you got him.
Right.
Right. Why he continued to do it and why it still got over, that I don't know.
And
because I remember seeing The Rock show up at some sort of MTV, you know, beach house horse shit, you know, and he was wearing a fucking, you know, like a really fancy Gucci, almost Hawaiian shirt, you know, open, completely open, walking around in loafers like human beings do.
Yes.
He walks into a room as some guy is walking out, and they're standing in the doorway, and the guy goes, "Oh my God, The Rock." And he goes, "Hey man, you're a big fan of The Rock, huh? Yeah. Thanks a lot, man. It's great. Nice to meet you. Hey, tell me, what do you think of The Rock's $500 shirt?" And this is the first time I ever heard it. And the guy goes, "Oh, I think it." He goes, "It doesn't matter what you think." And I thought that was the funniest shit ever.
Yeah.
Of course. Now, if you're in the ring with him and you're trying to get over too, and he's hitting you over the head with that, and you look like a dumb shit,
right?
Well, that kind of sucks. So, yeah, tough to be a worker in that environment. But if you're a worker in that environment, it's one of these things, you know, it's like no matter how much Hulk Hogan was a piece of shit for wanting to hold on to his spot, everyone wanted to be on his card for years.
Yeah.
Because they made more money.
Of course. And, I mean... I'm not trying to say that the general consensus is wrong.
No.
I'm just trying to say that
you just didn't get it.
Necessarily, it wasn't for me. You know, much like how mint chocolate chip is not for everybody either.
Right.
It has been said that anything can happen here in the World Wrestling Federation, but now more than ever, truer words have never been spoken. This is a conscious effort on our part to open the creative envelope, so to speak, in order to entertain you in a more contemporary manner. Even though we call ourselves sports entertainment because of the athleticism involved, the key word in that phrase is entertainment. The WWF extends far beyond the strict confines of sports presentation into the wide open environment of broad-based entertainment. We borrow from such program niches like soap operas, like The Days of Our Lives, or music videos such as those on MTV, daytime talk shows like Jerry Springer and others, cartoons like The King of the Hill on Fox, sitcoms like Seinfeld, and other widely accepted forms of television entertainment. We in the WWF think that you, the audience, are quite frankly tired of having your intelligence insulted. We also think that you're tired of the same old simplistic theory of good guys versus bad guys. Surely the era of the superhero who urges you to say your prayers and take your vitamins is definitely passé. Therefore, we've embarked upon a far more innovative and contemporary creative campaign that is far more invigorating and extemporaneous than ever before. However, due to the live nature of Raw and the War Zone, we encourage some degree of parental discretion as it relates to the younger audience allowed to stay up late. Other WWF programs on USA, such as Saturday Morning Live Wire and Sunday Morning Superstars, where there's a 40% increase in the younger audience, obviously, however, need no such discretion. We are responsible television producers who work hard to bring you this outrageous, wacky, wonderful world known as the WWF. Through some 50 years, the World Wrestling Federation has been an entertainment mainstay here in North America and all over the world. One of the reasons for that longevity is, as the times have changed, So have we. I'm happy to say that this new vibrant creative direction has resulted in a huge increase in television viewership, for which we thank USA Network and TSN for allowing us to have the creative freedom, but most especially, we would like to thank you for watching. Raw and the War Zone are definitely the cure for the common show.
Well, I mean, their focus really for years
was
on interesting characters.
Yeah.
And a guy who refers to himself in the third person and as a mineral.
The Great One.
Yes, he refers to himself as a mineral,
yeah.
The Rock, and wears sunglasses and loafers and tiny shorts and just open $500 shirts.
Yeah.
It was interesting because I remember a buddy of mine, he hadn't watched wrestling in some years, and all of a sudden I came over to his apartment and he had a picture of The Rock in his bedroom.
Of course.
Wall, just torn out of a magazine.
Of course.
And it was just like, and those catchphrases when it was early on were thrown around a bit. Now, like I say, as the innovation stopped, so did the interest.
Yes.
Yeah. But what do you want to do? That's how it goes.
Yeah, man.
But you didn't even like the early stuff, which is not wild to me because I understand that you're a different kind of cat.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the 80s. You didn't like much of anything that WWE produced?
I enjoyed the matches, you know, like especially tag team wrestling back in the 80s, right? I didn't mind
the Rockers.
Yeah, I loved the Rockers. I loved the Hart Foundation. I loved the British Bulldogs, right. The Killer Bees.
Yeah, they had some good ones.
The Quebecers. You know,
the Quebecers.
The tag wrestling was brilliant. The psychology that was used to build the matches, right. I thought was also outstanding. I enjoyed the 80s,
right,
and the early 90s more than I enjoyed the late 90s as far as WWF's product is concerned.
Right. Wild. Yeah. You didn't like the most popular product during its most popular era.
Yeah.
Now. I don't even know what to say to it.
I don't know either.
It's funny. Yeah, it's funny too, because like, you know, look, we're professional wrestling fans and we like the history of it. And we go back and we watch a lot of tape.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll watch some old Mazawa and Kenta Kobashi. And we'll, and, you know, my thing right now is when I get home from work, I turn on the TV and I put on wrestling because I need to make some business related phone calls. And I turn the volume down because wrestling is a perfect thing you can watch without hearing anything.
Right.
So I can make the phone calls uninterrupted and I can just look up and see whatever's going on. I have the volume up a little bit so I can hear it so that the phone won't pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I know what's going on. And I don't watch a whole lot of modern day stuff. I watch, you know, AEW live on Wednesdays. But these after work, I'll pull up. Not documentaries or any of the stuff that WWE produces, because it all feels sort of kayfabe to me,
mm-hmm.
Even when it's probably not that much. I'll pull up old episodes during the late 90s of WCW and Raw.
Yeah.
And I basically back during that peak and I'll watch those shows and they're fun.
Yeah.
I mean, to me.
Yeah.
They're entertaining.
Well, it's been a while since I've watched it. Yeah. I just remember how it made me feel.
At the time.
And I remember always rather watching WCW, like, or ECW.
Well,
like, I remember it.
It's great that you're a moves guy. Because, yeah, you're in a situation where you're training other people, which is perfect. But there is something to be said about knowing how to work. And that is, there is another shift, basically, with the new millennium, that a lot of people who were inspired in the same way that you were by the cruiserweight division and World of Sport and any number of things are more focused on moves and maybe less on work. And maybe they feel that because of the advent of the internet or the popularity of the internet, that kayfabe is completely worthless. And why do we bother?
Yeah.
I think it's still important to know to be that interesting character and to do those things, to get those butts in the seat so that they can see those fun moves.
Yeah, absolutely. No. It's
I didn't realize you were going to put it so shortly. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you're nailing a lot of things on the head. Like, it's something that I think that if you want to be a professional wrestler, you have to know how to wrestle. Because if you are a professional wrestler and you don't know how to wrestle, you're not a professional wrestler.
Sure.
Like, it's just a matter of, and there's a lot of, psychology-wise, the way that The Rock built his matches were brilliant, you know, but as far as fundamentally and technically and things like that, he threw a really good clothesline, you know, like he had his arm capture DDT with the nip up and stuff like that. It was just, you couldn't have him hook a sharpshooter for real, right? You know, and stuff like
There's
that.
There's a lot
and
of people. I do not know why no one asked Bret Hart, hey, how do you do this legit? Because I feel I'm just faking my way through it. No one seemed to fucking want to ask Bret Hart, how do I do this legitimately?
Yeah.
So it's like he was the only one that ever did it right. Well, I think Cesaro I saw did one like, because I mean, there's like a fulcrum point where you got to swap the legs in a right order and flip over in the right way.
Yeah.
So that the bridge is on like the shin essentially.
Yeah.
But when you see guys just grab both legs and turn over, it's sloppy shit. Whatever.
Yeah.
Excellence
of execution for a reason.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
I just wish more people would do their homework when they see something, go, hey, that's cool, I want to do a little tribute. Like, fucking pay attention to the mechanics of this.
I watched a guy, and I don't remember his name, but he was based out of California and he was like a make pretend Canadian.
Mm.
And he was in a multi-man at FSW. And he ended up catching a guy's drop kick. And he had both legs. And he like blew his mind. He was like, oh, sharpshooter! And then proceeded to completely botch it.
Right.
And and the crowd actually got excited for it at first because they're like, oh, here's this guy with like a maple leaf, like printed out on the ass of his long tights.
Right.
You know, he's got the singlet on, man. Like, and he was in it. Like, and he proudly proclaimed the next move that you were going to see is going to be a tribute to the greatest technician of all time, Bret the Hitman Hart. Canada's own. It's called the sharpshooter. You're going to love it.
Here it goes.
And there it went. And it was fucking hilarious.
I'm fucking over tribute.
Yeah.
To your heroes.
Yeah.
I wish, I really want this for the industry. People in not necessarily innovating, but putting together their own series of signature moves that is not based on someone else who was huge, who popularized it. There's no reason that Kevin Owens should be doing a fucking stunner.
Right.
That move was done by the most famous, most successful person in his profession of all time. And he will always be in the shadow if he uses that move. Every single person who fucking does a spear, I don't know, Goldberg maybe, is the first to really... Not the first, but he was the first on major network or cable television to popularize it.
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong on that? Is there someone else?
Rhino was using it around Rhino the same not, time.
I love Rhino. I love the gore.
Yeah.
It's my favorite version of it from my favorite person because his name is fucking Rhino.
Yeah.
And he gores people. But he was not as ever reached the heights of Goldberg.
Well, and I think that tribute is one thing, and I feel like I'm okay with it because the majority of my students use moves that I have taught them.
Right. Yes, I know this. But
for me, though, like Austin tried passing the torch to Owens, right? I think that that is one thing that
it would be. I don't think he passed it to him. He asked him, can I do the stunner and Austin finally went, yeah, fuck it. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Who cares at this point? I don't think Austin gives a fuck about the industry today.
Well, he has words on that one, on the stunner specifically. And he's like, I'm just surprised nobody's asked me to use it sooner. I would love for somebody to ask me to use it. And he has a relationship with Kevin Owens that's actually rather personal.
Sure. I'm talking about from the point of view of a fan.
Of course.
I want people to create their own sort of signature moves. It's a signature for a reason. It's got your signature on it. And yeah, I love Kevin Owens, but I wish he didn't do that.
Right.
I wish the 20 people that do the sharpshooter wouldn't do the sharpshooter.
Right.
Or the spear. Ricky Starks, I saw, did a spear when he lost the FTW title the other day.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Why are you doing a spear? Don't enough people have that fucking move?
You know?
There's this hand super kicks. Pick your poison. There's this number of moves that have been established that these are the moves of the greats, and everyone gets to dabble. And it's like, wouldn't you rather do something new and interesting, or at least go back further to something that people don't remember?
Right. And I think that for me, I use that mindset and that philosophy. And if I see something that's cool,
yeah,
I'm like, okay, how can I make that belong to me now? What's the modification that I can put on it? But at the same time, there's other moves the Anaconda Vice and the Crossface are moves that I will use every now and again because they are...
Anaconda Vice hasn't been done by anyone except for you.
Well,
since CM Punk, it seems.
Yeah, and whereas the Crossface, you know, like there's just... When I took the Crossface, I'm like, okay, well, I want to do the Crossface, but I want to do the Crossface different than anyone else does it. I'm going to have a bunch of different setups to go into it. One of them I lifted from Jimmy Rave, sure, and other ones I made on my own. So there was a plethora. There was one that D'Lo Brown helped me out with.
I will say this, just from a fan's point of view. No. I'm not trying to tear you down or spit on it. Setups is for workers only.
Yeah.
Fans don't fucking, you know, because it's the end result that we go, oh, he got him in the thing.
Right.
I don't think that the fans in general would discern the difference.
Subconsciously, they'll always react to it, though, because the thing that makes, for instance, the RKO, mm-hmm, a.k.a. the Diamond Cutter, a.k.a. the Ace Crusher, right? So the thing that makes that move special...
Was the Ace Crusher Johnny Aces?
Ace, yes.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah.
Is that when he was riding a fucking skateboard, or was he in
All Japan? No, that was when he was All Japan. Ah. Yeah, there was the Ace Crusher 1 and the Ace Crusher 2. The Ace Crusher number 2 was the Rocker Dropper, a.k.a. the Famasser. So
I hate the RKO and the Diamond Cutter. I don't think it's been done in an exciting way. Well, I'll take that back. I think that watching every Randy Orton match to figure out how's he going to do his one thing that he does that everyone goes, oh, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
How's he going to do that? That's interesting, I guess. But I mean, at this point.
And that's the argument that I'm not going to say as an argument, but right, the point of debate that I was going to bring up was the fact that it's not the move that gets over. It's how he gets into it.
Sure.
That's what's over about the RKO. And even when Diamond Dallas Page did it, it was always, how is he going to get to the Diamond Cutter? When I was using the Crossface,
I didn't think that way with Diamond Dallas Page.
Yeah. But
it was just exciting when he did it.
If you go and watch, though, and you listen to the commentators, that was the thing that Mike Tenay was always driving home. And he would say the reason why the Diamond Cutter is one of the most lethal moves in professional wrestling is because he can hit it from out of nowhere. And that's what makes the move special. And when I was doing the Crossface, the fans would eventually like, okay, well, how is Cody going to get into the Crossface? And I always did it differently every time. Mm-hmm. And like I said, sometimes it's not the move. It's how you're going to get there. And that is the art of manipulating a crowd to react to one thing.
Mm. We might be on different sides of the fence.
And that's okay. Well, but, all I know is that when I was using the Crossface and I would go into it differently, it was the reaction of he got to it from there.
Sure.
That's how it worked for me.
It just never rung for me.
Yeah.
And I, in that way.
And that's okay.
I'll move on. Yeah. We're not. What do you want to fight?
Yeah, let's go.
Let's
buddy.
Move these mics out of the way and fucking do a bunch of crossfaces to each other.
There it is.
Well, it's clear that we're going to have to do a part two.
It is clear.
So let's put a bow on the golden era of the 80s, the attitude era of the 90s, and bring it back around to Vince McMahon, who we completely abandoned. Because we were talking about every great thing that he did, essentially.
Yes.
I really think that the 80s and 90s, you know, he catches a lot of shit for certain things, and they're deserved. But he's just a businessman running a business, and he was running a business with other business people who were fucking close-minded, and they had no aspirations to be any more successful than what they were.
He made WWE
mm-hmm.
not just a household name in North America.
WWF.
He made that company known worldwide.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, that's... He made it worldwide. He also polished up the image of it. As much as we like Southern wrestling, he polished up the image of it for the rest of the country. As much as most people who like Southern stuff or more hard-hitting, you know, variations of it, he made it palatable for a lot of people. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, hopefully, once they mature and they go, they see ECW or something like that, or World Class, or, you know, even WCW or Jim Crockett, they go, hey, I like this even better.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really a choose your own adventure at that point.
Think about the marketing of action figures,
mm-hmm.
right? And,
oh, well, I mean, as a marketing person, that's where he's an actual genius.
Yeah.
I do not like throwing around the term genius loosely. And people say it about him all the time. He was just a fucking really great businessman.
Yeah.
But as a marketing personality or person, yeah, he was genius in that regard.
From the gear that the wrestlers wore to the music that was produced in-house to...
I don't want to breeze past the gear. That was really important. The fact that they wore loud colors, they were not... None of them were the same. If one guy's name was Adam, no one else could be a fucking Adam.
Yep.
You know, like, these are all little things that were very smart. And then it's even outside of the industry. You know, Hulk Hogan was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And that was not ever done before, and it hadn't been done since, as far as I know. I guess maybe Becky Lynch or something today, but Sports Illustrated is not what it once was.
Correct.
Brilliant marketer.
Yeah.
A little obnoxious. As well.
Little.
You remember the Beyond the Mat scene where they're having the marketing meeting and they're going over all the merch, and someone brings out that plastic frame and it's like Stone Cold Steve Austin's visage is coming out of the frame and the eyes move, and the person's explaining this. Oh, this is a, you know, it's basically like one of those Billy Basses.
Yeah.
Where the eyes move and it wiggles. It's like a motion detector. Something moves in the room and this thing goes, you know, because Stone Cold said so or whatever, you know, and he's like, oh, great, or whatever, you know. Why the fuck do we need this in the world?
Right.
It's just going to go in the ocean one day.
Right. Yeah, and it's going to, like...
It's going to choke out a fucking whale.
Yep, it's going to hurt wildlife.
Yes, it's going to give a stunner to a porpoise.
Yep. What? There it is. But yeah, it's undeniable to, and people removing the art from the artist and stuff like that. He was a businessman, and he made business very profitable for himself and the people he employed for many, many years.
I guess that's the mark of a good business and a good business person. What was that grunt?
Didn't necessarily say that he's a good business person.
You don't think he's a good business person?
It depends on what you describe as good.
He's worth $3.6 billion when he retired at 77.
Doesn't seem fair.
No, it sure doesn't.
Turnbuckle Boogie is a Devo Looter production and is produced by Timothy Styles and Cody Hancock, with web production and music provided by Timothy Styles. For more information, go to turnbuckleboogie.com. And for booking information on Cutthroat Cody Hancock, go to cutthroatcody.com. See you next Monday.